He'll let us know all about the invasive starry stonewort. Thanks for listening to KAXE. More news is next.
Good morning. First responders are still searching for people missing after the flash flooding in Central Texas. We'll hear from a Coast Guard officer helping organize some of those efforts on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. The health of children in the U.S. is getting worse. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A new study says they're more likely to have depression and obesity than about a decade ago. Symptoms like poor sleep and loneliness are also on the rise. Also, why the Trump administration sued an entire district of federal judges in Maryland, and how French winemakers are reacting to President Trump's tariffs. It is Tuesday, July 8th. On this day in 1776, Colonel John Nixon gave the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence outside the State House in Philadelphia. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, is headed to Qatar, where Israeli and Hamas officials are negotiating a ceasefire in Gaza. Trump has said he's hopeful for a ceasefire deal this week. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
A senior Israeli official told reporters that Israel and Hamas have resolved 80 to 90% of the terms of a ceasefire deal, but that it could take more than just a few days to reach a final deal. The agreement would include a 60-day ceasefire, exchanging hostages and prisoners. The main disagreements include Israel's demand to keep troops in a corridor captured in recent months, cutting across Gaza, and Hamas's demand for guarantees that talks during a ceasefire lead to a final end of war. Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met yesterday in the White House. Trump said the U.S. will hold talks with Iran following the U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran's nuclear sites. Netanyahu said he'd like a security pact and eventual peace between Israel and Syria. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It's a race against the clock to find survivors of the devastating flash flooding in Texas. Hope is fading at the same time. Ryan Logue is a volunteer with the United Cajun Navy. He spoke to ABC News.
We're out there early and we're out there till we're falling over. When you looked at these guys, we're exhausted. They were emotionally tired by looking at the devastation, finding children's Bibles on the ground, you know, looking through people's wreckage of their life. It takes a toll on you.
Logue also explains how volunteers are clearing masses of debris in search of victims. He says the search area is expansive, with just piles of debris the size of multiple 18-wheelers. The death toll from the July 4th floods keeps rising, with many people still missing today. The number of lives lost has surpassed 100, including 27 girls and counselors who were at sleepaway camp in Kerr County. U.S. importers are looking at several more weeks of tariff limbo. NPR's Scott Horsley reports President Trump is pushing back his deadline for higher import taxes.
President Trump has notified more than a dozen trading partners he plans to impose import taxes of 25% or more. That's at least 2.5 times the existing levy. But Trump says the effective date of those higher tariffs will be August 1st. And if history's any guide, the president could change his mind before that. Higher tariffs had been set to take effect on Wednesday on goods from countries that failed to strike new trade agreements with the U.S. The federal government is collecting tens of billions of dollars a month in tariff revenue, while foreign companies may absorb some of that cost. Most of the bill is paid by U.S. businesses and consumers. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News from Washington. As retailers weigh the potential impacts of those tariffs, Amazon Prime is extending its annual Prime Day to 4 days. The e-commerce giant's discounts start today and go through Friday. Competing retailers are having their own coinciding discount days. Target is trying to lure shoppers with Circle Week, and Walmart Deals starts today. Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR. A Swiss drug regulator approved the first malaria treatment specifically designed for newborns and infants. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert explains, the drug fills a long-standing gap in treatment for the deadly disease.
Roughly 30 million babies are born in areas with high malaria risk across Africa. There's not great data on how many are infected, but children under 5 account for nearly 3/4 of malaria deaths in the region. When cases in newborns and the smallest infants get severe, doctors had been giving drugs designed for older children in smaller doses. But babies metabolize drugs differently, so that strategy can potentially cause toxic overdose. The new formulation is called Coartem Baby. It was specifically formulated by the pharmaceutical company Novartis for newborns and small infants and can be dissolved into breast milk or formula. Approval in several African countries with a lot of malaria is expected in the coming weeks. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Sean Diddy Combs has a virtual hearing today to discuss his sentencing. His attorneys want to expedite the timeline. A jury found Combs guilty of transportation to engage in prostitution last week. He was acquitted of racketeering and sex trafficking. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
A lot of people take the support of their spouse, family, girlfriend, boyfriend. That's their rock.
This is Beyond Active Duty, caring for those who served. A series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
I'm John Boyd, and served in the Army National Guard for 24 years, and now serve in the civilian sector in software architecture. Unfortunately, the cost for me was high. You know, the loss of a marriage, time away from kids, the stress of being away and having to deal with family matters while you deployed, all those things that go into the deployment, that's the price that I pay. The second deployment to Iraq was a little bit more exciting because I was married and we just had our first child. As I was deploying, we entered divorce proceedings. I got to deploy as a very new divorcee. And my son was new. He was only about a year old. We're also having to, in a very short time, go through the divorce proceedings, try to figure out what child support's going to look like, update my family care plan. It was a mess, and I had less than 30 days to do all of that stuff.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. The Texas Hill Country is reeling from the devastation caused by deadly floods.
The number of fatalities continues to increase 4 days after the overflowing Guadalupe River ravaged parts of the area. And residents are starting to ask whether this could have been prevented.
NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran is in Kerrville, Texas, and joins us now. Hi, Sergio.
Hi, Layla.
So let's start with the latest. What do we know now about fatalities? It's gone up?
Yeah. The latest news is very unfortunate. State authorities have said that at least 100 people have died as a result of the floods, but the vast majority of those fatalities are in one county, here, Kerr County. The sheriff's office says 84 people were killed. This figure includes 56 adults and 28 children. Others remain missing. So truly devastating news here.
It's just so many children. Were most of them at that Christian summer camp, Camp Mystic, that sits along the river?
Yeah, presumably. You know, local authorities did not provide a breakdown in their last update, which happened in the form of a social media post yesterday, and different from the press conferences they had been holding twice a day. But Camp Mystic, which is the all-girls Christian summer camp along the Guadalupe River that you mentioned, has said that 27 campers and counselors were killed in the floods. I went up to the camp, Layla, and parts of it were swept away, and the area surrounded were completely destroyed. And you know, even people who survived the floods, like Paul Scherer, have mentioned how painful it is to see so many kids die. Mm.
These kids that were there were like 7, 8, 9, and 10-year-olds. They had a big life ahead of them, and it's pitiful that this happened to them.
Scherer is 74 and was living in a small apartment by the Guadalupe River. He had to evacuate in the early hours of Friday when the water was already about 4 feet tall in the parking lot. He lost his home, but he says he's lucky and that he's praying for the families of the girls who died.
And Sergio, I mean, one of the big questions is about whether people were warned in time with enough notice to get out of the way of these flash floods. What are people telling you on the ground?
Yeah, you know, almost all of the residents I've talked to in Kerry County say they did not get an alarm. Some got text messages, but they say it happened as the river was already on their steps. One of them told me he'd like the state to have an alarm system along the river. And this is something, you know, I've also heard from other folks. They want flood sirens or something like that. And politicians lately seem to be listening. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick told Fox News yesterday the state needs to step up and pay for an alarm system along the Guadalupe River.
Had we had sirens along this area, up and down, the same type of sirens that they have in Israel when there's an attack coming, that would have blown very loudly, it's possible that that would have saved some of these lives.
Now, it's been 4 days of search and rescue. Is anything changing at this point?
At this point, search and rescue operations continue. The governor has said it's a 24/7 operation. Yesterday, I was by the riverbank and law enforcement agents were searching the area. And as the water volumes recede, you can clearly see the destruction in the area. So cleaning crews are now out in the streets too, removing debris from the river and the roads.
That's NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran in Kerrville, Texas. Thank you for your reporting.
You're welcome.
As we just heard, first responders are still searching for people who are missing after the floods that swept central Texas. Among those searching are members of the U.S. Coast Guard. Commander Nathan Shakespeare is the Coast Guard Air Operations Officer overseeing the Guard's response. He's at the Coast Guard base in Corpus Christi, and he was nice enough to take a few minutes to talk to us on the line now. Good morning, Commander. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Can you describe the scope of operations that the Coast Guard has been conducting near Kerrville?
Yeah, absolutely. The Coast Guard is very quickly on Friday morning was notified about the response, and we maintain two assets on ready status all the time. So we launched our ready helicopter here in Corpus to head that way. It's 150 miles inland, so it's quite the trek for the Coast Guard and not an area that we're used to operating.
Yeah, I never thought about that. Do you have any sense of how many people the Coast Guard has helped to locate so far?
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, I think everyone's seen in the media the fantastic work of AST3 Ruskin. So on the ground here, he did the 165 number that's floating around. He helped those folks load into some partner helicopters, a Coast Guard Dolphin, Ian, Blair, and Seth. The rest of AST3 Ruskin's crew rescued 15 that day. And then we saved or assisted another 7 people.
Wow.
So we were really like the very kind of the bleeding edge of the response. We had the most impact.
You sure did. But can you just describe, like, is there a particular rescue or coordinated effort that stands out for you over these last several days? You know, recognizing that, you know, the entire team is, you know, participating and helping in this effort. But can you just, you know, give us one story?
Sure, absolutely. So I would say the thing that's really sticking out to me is just the fantastic work from Ian and the crew to get the helicopter 150 miles inland in some really atrocious weather conditions and try to get on scene. So initially they took off from Corpus and tried to fly low, working up the valleys, but the rain was so thick and the clouds so low, they ended up having to punching into the clouds inadvertently and climbing up, diverting to San Antonio. They tried to go above the clouds and do an instrument approach in the helicopter down to Kerrville. Unfortunately, the intensity of the rain working with the air traffic control was just too much. They were unable to punch through the weather at altitude, so they diverted for a second time. On their third attempt to go in, they kind of tried to loop in from the southwest of the storm, and then were unsuccessful then again because of the extreme weather. And only on the fourth time were Ian and the crew able to work up a valley and make it into the operating area and make it to Camp Mystic to begin their operation. So just it's a little tough to describe in the truncated time here, but you know, taking off at 6:30 a.m. in the morning and then getting on scene 7 hours later with four different kind of bites at the apple, trying really hard to get the helicopter and the air crew in to effect some rescues. A Herculean effort.
I think you did a great job describing it. I mean, I think I get the picture, and it sounds incredible. It required incredible skill and incredible training, and, you know, thank you all for this work. But can I just ask you this? The logistics of this are hard enough. How about the emotional toll of this?
Sure, absolutely. I would say the interesting thing about that is just how much control we have and how much visibility we have. So the Coast Guard is so oriented to our ability to support operations kind of at the shore and looking offshore. So, you know, kind of in contact with Ian and the crew throughout the day for their attempts to get in and trying to do some coaching and help and kind of validate the plan and the assumptions as they're working their way inland. And then, at least for me, kind of an emotional toll as I get on scene. The communications are just so limited for the Coast Guard there that once he's on scene, we have no idea what they're doing. You know, they're flying so low that they're not on air traffic control radar. We don't have communications with them. And, you know, we're not texting our crews in the plane. So really kind of just a lot of trust in the crew once they took off on that fourth leg that they were going to make it in there and make an impact. So I talked to Ian the next time after he's on deck in Kerrville, and he had left Ruskin on scene, but the helicopter had ran out of gas. So they were getting gas. I got a kind of a quick brief from Ian on his plan and his intentions. And he took off back again. So there's really no discussion at the time about like the impact or the number of life saves. Everything's very mission focused and kind of how we're going to accomplish the next step.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this. And thank you for your service and that of your other colleagues and teammates. We all appreciate it and we're all thinking of you. That's Air Operations Officer Nathan Shakespeare. He's been leading U.S. Coast Guard rescue operations in Texas. Commander, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
104. That's the number of confirmed deaths as of this hour in Central Texas. Lives swept away in flash floods, many of them children. There are dozens more unaccounted for. And for the next couple minutes, we want to tell you about the lives lost and the ongoing search for the missing, starting with Bill Giovanni Venus. He's a veteran who served in the military for 33 years, and he's missing. His son, William Venus Jr., flew to Texas to search for him when his aunt called to say she couldn't find him.
Venus has been twice about helping people. I'm hoping this is the situation that happens. If there's a line of people that are in need of services, he's going to put himself last. That's what he's always done.
William told us he'd located his dad's car on a bridge, and he planned to head there after he finished speaking with us. He said he's praying that Bill is out there doing what he does, using his skills as a mechanic to help people in this moment of crisis.
He used that skill set to help people all throughout his life. Like he saw you pulled over on the side of the road, but it doesn't matter what time of day or night.
Ty Baden of Beaumont, Texas, went on CNN to tell the country about his missing 21-year-old daughter, Joyce Catherine Baden. She'd been staying at a house in Hunt, Texas, along the Guadalupe River with three friends, a house that's no longer standing.
We waited around at a center, the place where all the survivors are brought, and we were hoping that we would hear our daughter and friends' names called, but they never did call.
So they stopped waiting and they started searching.
They found Joyce, but she did not survive. On Monday, her mother, Kelly Baden, shared these words on Facebook. We found our lovely daughter who blessed us for 21 years. We pray to be able to find her three friends soon. There are pictures of a smiling, beautiful Joyce.
Also lost in the floods was 68-year-old Cynthia Ragsdale, who went by Jane. She was camp director and co-owner of Heart of the Hills Camp near Hunt. This is how Ragsdale's pastor, Jaciel Hernandez Garcia, of First Presbyterian Church in Kerrville, remembers her.
A light who shone really brightly, who provided spaces for young kids, for young women, to be in God's nature as someone who was committed to mission work, especially at our church.
Those are just a few of the names and the stories of the loved ones lost and missing in Central Texas. We remember them this morning. This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. John Latimer will be joining me shortly. Support comes from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative serving more than 44,000 members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. Gradually clearing today, high 76 to 80, slight chance for showers, lows tonight in the mid to upper 50s, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 78 to 82. The U.S. House of Representatives recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media that was already allocated. This goes to the Senate next. Proposed cuts will hit rural and tribal stations the hardest. Tell Congress, protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. ProtectMyPublicMedia.org will connect you to your elected officials. The United Way of Bemidji and the Community Resource Connections are coordinating storm relief efforts like debris removal and more for residents on private property. Find resources by calling 218-333-0880 or at crcinform.org. Donations to the Disaster Recovery Fund may be made at unitedwaybemidji.org. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program, which aims to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline to apply is November 30th. Find more at bluethumb.org.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. It turns out that the kids are not all right. That is the conclusion of a study that indicates the health of America's children has significantly worsened since 2007. As NPR's Maria Godoy reports, that includes the number of kids and teens with chronic diseases.
Dr. Christopher Forrest is a professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He says 25 years ago, it was pretty uncommon to see kids come in with chronic conditions, but that's changed.
We've been seeing sort of anecdotally more and more kids come in to the hospital, come into specialty clinics, and also populate our primary care practices with more chronic disease. They just seem to be sicker.
It turns out they are. In a new study in the journal JAMA, Forrest and his colleagues report that a U.S. child was 15 to 20% more likely to have a chronic condition in 2023 than a child in 2011. In particular, the prevalence of depression, anxiety, and obesity all increased. So did symptoms like poor sleep and loneliness.
I think the overall message is that children's health in the United States has been declining for almost two decades.
The researchers also looked at mortality rates for American infants, kids, and teens and compared them to their peers in other high-income countries over time.
In the 1960s, the chance that a child was going to die in the United States was the same as European nations.
But he says that's no longer the case.
What we found is that from 2010 to 2023, kids in the United States were 80% more likely to die.
Among infants, these disparities were driven largely by sudden unexpected infant death and prematurity. In older children and adolescents, the gap was fueled by firearm injuries, motor vehicle crashes, and substance abuse. Dr. Frederick Rivera is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington. He says healthcare coverage is one big reason why American kids seem to fare worse than their peers in other rich nations.
And now that's going to get worse with kids being removed from Medicaid.
That's because of the huge cuts to the Medicaid program included in the tax and spending bill President Trump signed into law last week. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Will a future Syria protect and empower its minorities? It's a question being asked as the U.S. lifts sanctions on Syria and this week revoked the terrorist designation for the rebel group once led by the country's new president. That new president has promised to serve all Syrians. The largest ethnic minority group in Syria are the Kurds, many of whom reside in the semi-autonomous northeast, and the Kurdish-led administration there is negotiating with Damascus in hopes to unify Syria. To understand the status of those negotiations, I spoke to Mahmoud Maslat. He's an Arab Syrian who co-chairs the Syrian Democratic Council, which is the political wing of the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. I started by asking what guarantees the Kurds want from Damascus.
They want to have their rights through the constitution, and they want uncentralized government, like our region in northeast Syria. Mm-hmm. But that has to come through negotiation. We try to see Syria unified again. They trying to distance themselves from their past, the new government. We are optimistic, but we would like to see result more than talk.
What is the biggest sticking point around negotiations?
The challenge is if they want to be part of the Syrian army, but they want to be as a SDF. Hmm. Also, in this negotiation, we don't want a one-color army or one-color constitution. Syria is very rich with our fabric. We have Druze, we have Alawite, we have Kurds, and they all need to be part of rebuilding Syria. The Kurds, they suffer a lot previously, and they need their language to be taught in our institution. The Druze, they want also to be part of this new government. We want Syrian governments, which represent the Syriac, the Assyrian, the Muslims, the Sunni, the Alawi, all Syrians. We will prevail in the end, but we want our future without any foreign intervention.
When you say without any foreign intervention, what do you mean? And also, what's the U.S. role been?
The problem is ISIS sleeper cells still around here, and Iranian, they are not going away from my country. So we want to make sure that American troops, they are not leaving, because I look at them as the safety valve in my region. So I will do my best to keep American soldiers in Syria until Syria is stabilized and there is no threat from the radicals or ISIS.
Do you have faith that this government, under the leadership of Ahmed al-Sharaa, wants the same things that you describe, these protections of minority rights, the teaching of diversity of Syria, the teaching of language, the integration of the SDF as a unit?
We face a brutal regime in the past, and there was, you've seen, I don't have to explain to you or to the listeners what Assad regime and the Ba'ath Party done.
Yeah.
But we will face them if they don't deliver what they said. It's a new Syria, and we fought and we gave like a blood for it. We don't want to fight nobody, and war is not an option for us.
But it sounds like it is an option if this government doesn't, as you say, sort of see a united Syria in their future and respect the rights of minorities.
Leila, what worries me, the foreign fighter, they integrate to the Syrian army. I need to see a Syrian army from Syria who defend and fight for Syria with their blood and soul. But they brought us some foreign fighter that used to be with the Al-Nusra Front or Al-Qaeda. And,
which is the branch of Al-Qaeda.
The branch of, yes, HTS. They gave them citizenship and they are part of the Syrian army. That worries me.
What do you want and need from the international community as Syria writes its constitution, builds its institutions, and works out how to bring together groups that had been fighting?
Syria needs the help of the international community, and especially the United States. We need them to come and invest in Syria. We want to make sure that they come like to an understanding with Turkey and with Iraq and with Iran, that we don't want any foreign elements involvement in our country. We want to build our own future by ourselves. But also, we are reaching to the international community to help us. We would like to thank them for lifting this action on us and trying to give us another chance to rebuild Syria, to see Syria prosperous again.
Mahmoud Maslat is co-chair of the Syrian Democratic Council. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leila. I appreciate it.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. is home to millions of oil and gas wells. When a well reaches the end of its life, it needs to get sealed up so it doesn't leak. But plugged wells do not always stay plugged, which can cause a big problem if one of them happens to be in your front yard.
Grass didn't grow. The pine trees kept dying.
On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. It is the Tuesday morning show. I'm Jennifer Barr sitting in for Heidi Holton today with John Latimer. Good morning.
Morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
I'm here.
Here we are.
I'm staring out the window.
Yep.
Lots of bird activity. A few flowers to check out. Looks like it's going to be a nice day. You tell me that it's going to be clearing. I'll take your word for it. I'm ready for some clear skies. You know, it's kind of amazing. We've had, since the first of the month, let's see, I've had rain on every day. I had first, second, third, fifth, sixth. No, maybe not the sixth. 7th and today the 8th.
Yeah.
Measurable precipitation every day.
All right.
So and we are probably not in any kind of drought here, at least around the Grand Rapids area. We may still be below average, but I had 4.25 inches of rain in the month of June, which was about average for June. That's about what we get, a little over 4 inches in an average June. Last year we got more than 4. We got 6 inches in one day, and that was a little distressing, but not at all like what's happening down in Texas.
Yeah. Well, you might be seeing some patchy fog early this morning, and it should be gradually clearing, highs in the upper 70s today. Northwest winds 5 to 10, and then tonight partly cloudy, lows 51 to 56. Tomorrow, sunny, highs 78 to 82, not much wind to speak of. And then Thursday, mostly sunny and a bit warmer, highs 81 to 85, slight chance for showers in the afternoon.
Later on this morning, of course, the phenology, well, we'll have student phenology later in this half hour. And about 50 minutes from now, we will have the phenology show talking about some of the midsummer sorts of things that happen. And then at 8:45 this morning, we're going to be talking about starry stonewort. Dr. Daniel Larkin, professor and extension specialist at the University of Minnesota, is going to join us. And we are going to talk about starry stonewort, another invasive species coming to a lake near you. You hope not. And we will learn more about that coming up before 9 o'clock this morning. So lots of things going on. Lots of things for you to tune in and get involved in.
Yeah.
This is community radio.
It is. And speaking of lakes, our question of the week is, What is your favorite thing to do in or on the water?
Oh, my.
And you can pick more than one favorite thing, of course. I know you you are a swimmer.
I am, yeah. I swam around the pit the other day. And I like to sail, too, on the water. I hadn't thought about that. I am attracted to water. I have water. I'm not, my horoscope is fire, I think, Sagittarius. But I am definitely a water person. I like that neutral buoyancy. I like that no weight on the body kind of thing. I did a lap of the pit the other day, first one of the year for me. I have been not swimming as much as I'd like to, but I got out and put my mind to it and swam all the way around, a little over a mile.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, felt nice. It was a good experience. The dog and I did a lap by ourselves and took in all the sights.
Your dog swims right alongside you?
Pretty much, yeah. She's kind of a cross trainer. She she swims and then she goes to shore and she runs along the shoreline a little bit and then she ends up back in the water. At one point, I don't look up very often. I'm just kind of looking at the bottom, watching things go by. And so if you're out swimming in that area, move out of my way because I'm not looking. But my dog, at one point, I tipped my head up to see where I was, and I was right at the end of a dock, and my dog is standing on the dock right beside me, looking down at me, and she leaps into the water right in front of me, just like, okay, let's go. So, yeah, she does a lot of swimming, but she's also interested in what's up on shore.
Yeah. Well, you can let us know your thoughts on our
and
question
you?
Of the week. Me? I am not much of a water person. I like to look at water. It's very pretty. I like to maybe dangle my feet or wade into some water. I can swim, but it's not my favorite thing to do. A slow boat ride might be nice, or I would, if I had a kayak, that seems like a lovely thing to do. But I mostly like to look at water.
Well, that's an enjoyable thing too. Water is one of those things that changes every day.
Yeah.
Color, the
throughout
texture,
the
it just always changing, never the same. So it does have its mysteries and its delights, especially for me.
Support for KAXE comes from Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty, helping guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. More at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com.
And support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m. Information about this summer's Martini Monday music series is available at timberlakelodgehotel.com.
Coming up, it's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. While Congress continues mulling over President Trump's fiscal agenda, part of the White House budget proposes to essentially defund tribal colleges and universities, reducing federal funding by nearly 90%. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports on how Arizona schools are bracing for devastation.
Among them is San Carlos Apache College, which is not your typical campus. The tribe has been building toward this dream of making higher education more accessible on the reservation for the last decade plus. That vision from San Carlos Apache Chairman Terry Rambler is still a work in progress, but one he's been contributing to in ways big and small.
So we asked the chairman if we could borrow his podium. We didn't know he had more than one.
Lisa Utsi is vice president and provost of San Carlos Apache College. She's talking about the first commencement in May 2020.
And so the next year, I had texted him or something, and I was just like, hey, can we borrow your podium again? But then I realized we found it, and he was like, just keep it.
That's been a theme for the chairman when it comes to piecemealing this makeshift campus together in the heart of San Carlos by slowly turning empty tribally owned buildings, including one home to old council chambers, into classrooms.
Actually, a lot of the artwork on the walls are things that the chairman donated.
Chartered in 2014, then officially opening its doors 3 years later, the college has graduated over 100 students.
I joke I was leaving, in a way, the most fully funded, built out, oldest tribal college.
Utsi used to be dean of faculty for Diné College, which was founded on the Navajo Nation in 1968.
To come to a college with no funding, no classrooms, no faculty.
By this fall, Utsi says the college expects to employ 8 full-time teachers and enroll 500 students, but they and another 36 indigenous schools across more than a dozen states are still dreading the worst. Trump wants to cut their federal funding by almost 90%, down to a collective $22 million. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from the San Carlos Apache Reservation.
U.S. senators have a deadline of July 18th to decide whether to eliminate federal funding for public media. South Dakota Republican Senator Mike Round sits on the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. He says supporting tribal radio stations is a priority through the process.
for our Native American reservations, there are some small radio stations in South Dakota and in some other states that really rely on some of that national public broadcasting funds to survive. We know that you want to revert some of those funds, but if you do that, some of these small stations that really provide emergency services information and community information, they may not survive.
Brown says White House counterparts have agreed to work with congressional leaders seeking to keep tribal-operated radio functional through the process. Over the weekend, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs visited the command center for the Oak Ridge Fire in Window Rock, Arizona, to get updates and offer her support. The Oak Ridge Fire is on the Navajo Nation near St. Michael's. Hobbs says her administration will continue to coordinate with the tribe to contain the fire and with recovery efforts. Tribal officials, including Navajo Nation President Boo Nigren and Navajo Nation Council Speaker Crystalyn Curley, met with Hobbs during the visit. As of Monday morning, the fire was covering more than 10,900 acres. It started on June 28th. Officials say the fire has not grown significantly in recent days and additional growth is not expected. Efforts will soon be shifting to the recovery phase of the fire. Officials say in the coming weeks, it will be critical to assess the fire's impacts on the land, vegetation, wildlife, and cultural sites. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation and funded by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It is 6:40. It's the Tuesday morning show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with John Latimer, and we were just talking about things we like to do in and on the water. That is our question of the week. We heard from Ian in Minneapolis. My favorite thing to do is grab a bar of patchouli soap and take a morning bath in a cool, fresh water lake. It's absolutely refreshing.
It certainly is, Ian. Good morning, by the way. Ian and I are associates. I'd like to say friends. We don't see each other as often as I'd like, but we had a very, very wonderful hike in Theodore Worth Park in Minneapolis one day and went through the wildflower gardens, and Ian was just picking them off and telling me all about them. It was a wonderful day. I remember it fondly, and I look forward to another one, Ian. And yeah, I'm with you. Give me a bar of soap and put me in cool water. I'd be happy. I might swim a mile before I washed up, but you know, gotta get it soaked a little bit. And you, I asked you, Jennifer. I'm so used to sitting here with Heidi, I guess I probably called her Scott for a couple of months after Scott left. We have had a discussion. I like to sail and to swim, and you like to dangle your toes in.
Yes.
And observe water, and that's pretty cool. I like that too. Mm-hmm. But let us know what you how you interact with the lakes and rivers in the area. There certainly are. We're blessed with lots of them. And speaking of lakes and rivers, we're going to be speaking later on this morning with an expert on the starry stonewort. And we will learn a bit more about that invasive species with Daniel Larkin. Dr. Larkin is a professor and extension specialist at the University of Minnesota, and he is a fellow at the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. So,
I want to ask him more about that center too. And And he'll be presenting on Thursday as part of Itasca Water's Practical Water Wisdom webinar series.
Right.
At noon.
Yep. You can register for that at Itasca Waters, I would expect.
Yep.
And get in and have a chance to listen to what he has to say about starry stonewort and some of the other invasive species. I was in Pacagama Lake over the 4th of July, and I was a little dismayed at the number of zebra mussels. Mm. I knew they were in the lake, and they've cleaned up the water. It's much easier to see to greater depths than before, but at what price? They were uncomfortable to walk on. I don't do a lot of walking in the water. Mostly I get in water that's deep enough to swim, and that's what I do. So I spend my time sort of floating and looking down the bird's eye view, I guess, of the bottom. But there were lots and lots and lots of zebra mussels in there. And I suspect that that will only continue to get worse, but maybe Dr. Larkin will have some good news for us, we'll hope.
Yep. It's coming up at 8:45. Second Harvest Northland is hosting a public meeting 1 o'clock today at the Grand Rapids Food Shelf to share information about recent changes there. The organization says it hopes to provide clarity and have conversations with community members. Also happening tonight, at Keith's Pizza in Bemidji, they are having pizza with a purpose from 5 to 8, and it's at their northern location at 1425 Paul Bunyan Drive, and 25% of the proceeds will benefit the United Way of Bemidji Area's Disaster Relief Fund, which has been going to help with storm damage recovery in that area. We have some talkbacks to get to.
All right, let's dive in and see who's been in touch with us. If you would like to join the voices that are heard here on KEXC, it's a pretty simple process. You just have to go out, observe, and make a simple recording of your notes and then send them to us, and we will be happy to play them on the air. Maybe you're a camp counselor somewhere and you'd like to get the voices of the campers out on air for people. Whatever the reason you have for getting out and sending us a note, we'd love to hear from you. Funding for our student phenology is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Phenology talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell. Our first report comes from our phenology reporter, our coordinator, Charlie Mitchell, who lives near Marine on St. Croix.
Good morning, John and Jennifer. This is Charlie reporting from the St. Croix River near Stillwater. We had some good soaking rains last week, and the river is running high and fast. All of the precipitation took down a birch tree along the riverbank on a neighbor's property, and yesterday the tree had washed downstream to settle on the river bottom near our place. It was a beautiful tree while it lived, arching over the river in a graceful manner and always filled with songbirds. We'll happily keep an eye on it in its new home, where we hope it will host plenty of muskrats and basking turtles. Other sightings along the Croix have included a juvenile great blue heron, plenty of swallows, and a roving raccoon. There are some daisies blooming, blue vervain, and the first of the Joe Pieweed in flower. At our place, we're seeing plenty of fledgling red-bellied woodpeckers, and our local house wren is busy feeding a growing brood. Meanwhile, another wren family sits on our newspaper mailbox atop a carefully constructed pile of twigs and eggs. Red baneberries are ripening, our crabapples are growing, and our Solomon seals are leaning over with the weight of their seeds. The basswood trees are blooming and perfuming the air with a delicate scent. It's a gorgeous time to be out, the mosquitoes are scarce, and I'm a happy camper. This has been Charlie Mitchell, going hither and thither on the St. Croix River.
Thank you, Charlie. The mosquitoes are out, and you know what? They are not, they're not bad. I mean, I have experienced much, much worse. And so I'm, even though the first half of the summer, well, all of June, went without a lot of mosquitoes at all to be noticed. Now, there are a few, but just a few. It's nothing compared to some years when you could clap your hands and kill five. It's a pretty easy summer so far. Deer flies are a little bit of a problem, but we will deal with them in their own fashion. Juvenile great blue herons and the swallows, roving raccoons, daisies blooming, blue vervain, and first Joe Pieweed in flower. Now, they are 160 miles south of us, and so it should be about 10 days before the pieweed blooms up here. I do not even see, looking at the pieweed that I'm looking at, I'm not even seeing flower buds yet, so it'll be a while before we have Joe Pieweed blooming here. Solomon seal is definitely in the berry stage, even around here, but our berries are pretty green. Red baneberries are ripening. The basswood trees are perfuming the air with their delicate scent. And that is just beginning to happen up here. We are just moving into our basswood flowering season. So if you have a basswood, It's a good time to go stand downwind of it and enjoy the smell. Our next report comes from the Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade, Minnesota.
Hello, this is Finley and Brecken from Four Corn Summer Camp at Long Lake Conservation Center the week of June 29th through July 3rd. July in Ojibwe is known as midsummer or half-summer moon, marking the halfway point of summer. The high temperature was a very summer-like 86 degrees Fahrenheit with a comfortable low temperature of 56. The woods and waters are at their peak with all things blooming and bursting with life. Our group heard but didn't see a barred owl. We encountered a painted turtle who found its way into the chef's garden where it was trapped. It was likely a mama looking to lay her eggs, so we let her out to complete her mission.
The big news was that we found the first monarch caterpillar of the season. It was a big one. That's about 2 weeks later than last year. Our observation is that there haven't been as many monarchs this year as in previous years. We noticed that there were very few mosquitoes, which is nice, but we wonder why. The wood ticks and deer ticks and horse flies, on the other hand, are plentiful. Our group saw and heard common loons on the lake, an unidentified large gray moth, bluebirds, a Cooper's hawk flying overhead, a large leopard frog, garter snakes, and a bunch of red and gray squirrels at the bird feeder. We named the largest gray squirrel Big Chungus. There are cocoons everywhere, and hornet's nests are springing up quickly and in lots of places. One of the highlights of the camp, we encountered a fawn during a nature hike. It stopped and stared at us for a few moments before running away. Pretty cool. We had a great week at summer camp and want to remind everyone to unplug, get outside, and live connected.
Thank you, Finley and Brecken. What a nice report and what a nice experience for some kids coming up from the cities. Barred owl, they got to hear. Painted turtle, they found her in the garden and helped her out. What a nice thing to do. Monarch caterpillars, that's always exciting. There are not as many monarchs this year as there have been in the past. I had a conversation with my friend Dallas Hudson over in Akeley, and he said probably not seen 10 yet all year, and I am above that. I probably have seen 20, but certainly fewer than I would hope to. And right now there are a bunch of fritillary butterflies that are out that are tiny bit smaller than the monarchs, but they are also orange and black and sometimes can be confused with monarchs, especially if you don't get a good look at them sitting. Maybe they're flying by and you just go, oh, orange and black, must be a monarch. A lot of fritillaries that fit that description. They noticed, as I mentioned, very few mosquitoes, which is nice, but we wonder why. I think why is because it was dry for so long that during the time of year when many of those mosquitoes would be developing as little larvae, they were too dry to actually get active. So wood ticks, deer ticks, and deer and horse flies all out in force. The wood ticks and deer ticks at my house are kind of running downhill. I mean, I'm not seeing very many of them right now. And that's typical this time of year. There'll be a resurgence in late August and early September, and the deer ticks will hang on until probably November. But the wood ticks will just have one more crack at us, and it'll probably be, as I said, late August or early September, and then they'll be done for another year, and we won't miss them. And these lucky kids and their other campers got to see a fawn during a nature hike. That is pretty cool. I know if I come from a big city and got into the woods and saw a fawn, I would be pretty thrilled, be pretty exciting. We heard from our good friends Axel and Pearl, who are spending their summer near Marcel, Minnesota.
Hi, this is Axel.
And Pearl Newstock.
The loon baby's growing.
The berries of the bluebead lilies are green.
The milkweed flowers are just blooming, and there are a few caterpillars on them. We saw a big garter snake.
We saw scarlet wax cap mushrooms.
The daisies are lining the road.
Yellow water lilies are gone, and white water lilies are in full bloom.
The arrow-leafed bindweed have beautiful white trumpet flowers and have just blooms.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you, Axel. Pearl, great report. The loon baby is doing fine. That's always good news. I fret over them. I'm like an overly active grandfather who can't let go. I love the little loons, and I hope that they all survive. Milkweed beginning to bloom up there. Lots of daisies blooming. Lots of interesting things going on in the Marcel area, and those two, I'll call them kids, Axel and Pearl, are certainly in their element up there in that area and having a good time. Next, we're going to take a quick look at what Chad Caddett's students at Little Falls Middle School are seeing this summer. You can look at the pictures on their Instagram page. The Instagram link is instagram.com/littlefallsphenology. So instagram.com and then /littlefallsphenology. And that also ends with a slash, which I've learned over the years means that you should do that, because if you don't, you'll probably end up in computer hell somewhere.
Also, there are underscores between the words, so Falls Phenology, it looks like. Or good. Just you can just search for them, too, once you get on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm sure that would be a good use of your time. I'll be at the lake.
Well, I will say they make good use of Instagram.
They do, and I'm impressed, because you think about it, students typically, when they leave school in the spring, they don't think about school until fall. And that's not the case with Chad's class. The kids are contributing a lot of pictures. They have a picture of the sulfur cinquefoil, a snapping turtle that David D. got a chance to photograph. And David also took a beautiful picture of a barn swallow, which is a bird that I don't see all that often up here, but certainly is beautiful. And Chad had a picture of the stinkhorn fungus and also the purple prairie clover, which is a gorgeous little flower and is just now beginning to bloom down in the Little Falls area.
Yeah, beautiful pink, kind of a hot pink.
Hot pink, yeah, sort of magenta with little yellow dots, the little stamens with the pollen on them sticking out of those flowers. It's pretty exciting. Other sightings that they have made down in Little Falls include house wrens, yarrow, mayflies, wild roses still blooming, and red elderberry. Up here, the red elderberry are definitely ripe, still not being eaten by any of the birds, and hopefully not by you either, because red elderberry is one of those plants that doesn't fall into the edible category. It's possible that some of you have figured out a way to eat them without the ill effects. But I do know that if you just went out and took a handful of red elderberries and threw them in your oatmeal, you would you'd see the oatmeal again real soon with the red elderberries pretty much intact. The elderberry has a lot of chemistry that prevents it from spending a long time in your body. It's coming out one way or the other, either the way it went in or the way most of the things that we eat come out. It's not going to stay in your body very long, so stay away from the red elderberry. Leave it for the birds. They'll enjoy it, and they'll survive the vicissitudes of red elderberry without, And we had from our final report this morning comes from last week's Season Watch newsletter. The weekly watch list highlighted four of the best name fungi found in Minnesota in July. And here are four of Charlie's favorites. And what's not to like about these? The red juice tooth, a white fungus that leaks red liquid, grows among the mosses and pine needles of coniferous forests. also known as strawberries and cream, devil's tooth, and bleeding tooth fungus. Lovely. The devil's dipstick, the stinkhorn family. This is a gift that keeps on giving to the gutter-minded mycologists. This species is red-orange with brown slime coating the tip. The slime attracts flies, which distribute the spores. The dog's nose fungus, or the dog's nose, let's see, dog's nose fungus is aptly named a black fungus with a wrinkly texture. It strongly resembles the look of a dog's nose. However, it'll leave black slime on your fingers if you touch it. And finally, among Charlie's four favorite named mushrooms of the summer, the ear pick fungus. There's no denying that the ear pick fungus looks like a lot like a creepily elongated hairy finger delving deep into an ear canal. They grow from leaf litter and fallen cones in the coniferous forests, especially near Scots pines. And there are some pictures with those. If you have not yet signed up for Season Watch newsletter, you should do that at KAXC.org. You won't be disappointed, especially with that kind of stuff coming your way.
I will say all of these, the pictures of all of these funguses look